Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Wrapping up in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem today, as Palestinians cast ballots in the first parliamentary election in the decade. Both the ruling Fatah Party and its challenger, the Islamic militant group Hamas, are predicting victory, but pollsters see the race as too close to call, with 700 candidates vying for 132 seats. Today, Fatah is essentially asking for another chance because it's been tainted by corruption, while Hamas has focused its message on clean government and has called Fatah's attempts to compromise with Israel a sign of weakness. Anne Barnard is covering the elections for the Boston Globe. She's the paper's Mideast bureau chief and joins us from Gaza. Where, Anne, can you set the scene for us? What has it been like today?
Well, today, Palestinians were streaming into the streets from an early hour in the morning. The campaign, although technically was supposed to be over on Monday, was really still continuing with forests of green and yellow flags, green for Hamas and yellow for Fatah, outside the polling stations, young boys carrying the flags on their bicycles, and people covering their cars with party paraphernalia. So there was a lot of excitement about the fact that people had a real choice for the first time, even though to many Hamas is not an entirely palatable choice, and it's raised many objections from Israel and the international community. It's the first time that Palestinians have really had an alternative to the Fatah party, which has dominated their politics for decades.
You say a huge turnout, relatively peaceful from what you've seen, but we did want to mention we read about a confrontation in East Jerusalem when right-wing Israeli lawmakers and extremists tried to force their way into a Palestinian polling place. They were turned back by dozens of policemen there. It seems as if that's an isolated event.
Yes, in Gaza, where actually much more violence had been seen during the pre-election period, mostly among rival factions within the Fatah party, today there was really nothing. There was maybe one scuffle that we heard about that was broken up quickly. So the intra-Palestinian fighting that people had feared did not materialize today.
You wrote today in the paper about talking to a group of young Palestinians, young men, who were all over the place across the spectrum in how they'd vote. One may be interested in Hamas, but he gestured at his kind of modern haircut and worried that maybe he wouldn't be able to have that haircut if Islamists ruled. It seems as if the people really are across the spectrum.
Well, what we saw actually was a combination of hardcore Hamas supporters who really are voting for Hamas because they support its ideology 100%. They believe in an Islamic State. They reject the compromises that Fatah has tried to make with Israel, and they believe that armed struggle is the only way to make progress with Israel. But we actually saw a very large number of voters also who were sort of unaccustomed to seeing themselves as Hamas supporters and in fact said they disagree with a lot of Hamas's platform, but they were going to vote for Hamas anyway because they were sick and tired of 10 years of rule by Fatah, which has brought them little progress either vis-a-vis getting a state or establishing a functioning economy. And they said, we just think it's important to have an opposition to shake up the political system.
Right. Well,
and then you had the Fatah loyalists who just believe in the legacy of Yasser Arafat and are loyal to Fatah.
Right. Well, we understand the gates to the polling places have now closed. And I'm wondering, we wait to find out, as do Palestinians, what are they doing? In just the few seconds we have, are they still milling about? Are they going home? What's the sense there?
People actually started to go home around lunchtime, and some people are still milling around in the streets waiting for news. We expect exit polls within about an hour to suggest who might be the winner, but at the moment, everybody's claiming that their own party has won, and really it's actually a good sign that in these elections, we actually don't know who the winner is going to be because the campaign was very robust and people were debating real issues, and the election seems to have gone smoothly in terms of fairness, according to the international observers. So we're looking at a real democratic outcome that we're going to see in a few hours.
Yeah, in fact, it could be a coalition government if there's no clear winner. Anne Barnard, Middle East Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, covering the Palestinian elections for us and speaking to us from Gaza. Anne, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, here at home, President Bush continues his week-long media blitz in support of his domestic spying program, today making his case at the National Security Agency in Fort Meade, Maryland. This is the president's second speech this week in defense of the National Security Agency's interception of international communications between people in the U.S. and foreigners with suspected ties to Al-Qaeda, a policy first revealed by the New York Times. Critics say the president is end-running a special court set up in 1978 to issue warrants for domestic spying, that in fact his plan is illegal. The president's supporters, including former NSA Director Michael Hayden and Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, say spying is necessary and lawful in times of war, citing past presidents' intervention of mail and telegraphs. We'll have more on the history of domestic spying in a moment, but first, what is current law? Bob Turner, professor at the University of Virginia Law School and co-founder of the Center for National Security, supports the president's program. He joins us now. Welcome.
I'm glad to be here.
And we're also joined by Bob Reinstein, Dean of Temple Law School. He's very much against what is happening with the NSA. And Bob, thank you as well.
My pleasure.
I'm going to turn first to Professor Turner. The president's been saying that he needs to act without warrants, or the NSA needs to act without warrants because of time, because often agents need to act immediately. But this Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, I know you're very familiar with it, it allows for warrants for domestic eavesdropping to be granted up to 72 hours after a search. Why is that not enough for the Bush administration?
Well, the problem is, in order to get a warrant or to act under FISA, you have to have probable cause that the subject of the intercept is either a foreign power or an agent of a foreign power. And if bin Laden calls into this country or sends an email to an unknown American, we can't say that American is a, you know, this may be an eBay transaction. He's giving instructions on where to send a lamp or something. And so the question is, does the president have to then have the FBI investigate the American for 2 weeks to find out if he's a tie to terrorism, or should he be able to investigate without first having to do a long background and then go to the court?
Dean Reinstein, the Bush administration does say that the FISA Act is outdated and too slow. Is that your reading of it?
No, it's not. And actually, in that situation, that's a classic situation where they would get a warrant. The FISA includes, in the definition of foreign power, a terrorist organization. It applies to electronic communications between Americans and others in the United States and people abroad. And if there is a connection with a terrorist organization, you get a FISA warrant. And if there's an emergency under FISA, as you said, the eavesdropping can be conducted, and then the administration can go and get the warrant within 72 hours. You know, there's also a provision in FISA that says in the case of a declared war, the administration can conduct surveillance without warrants for 15 days. And my position, and I think a lot of people's position on this, is that if the president thinks that FISA is outdated and is too burdensome, what he ought to do is go to Congress and get it amended.
What about that, Professor Turner? If in fact, as you say, it would take too long, why not just get to Congress and get it changed?
Well, the real issue here is, which law do we obey? We have two different sets of law at play here. We have the Constitution that includes the Fourth Amendment that's very important, but we also have under the Constitution power to the president, both as commander-in-chief and as the holder of the executive power, to engage in this type of activity.
Let's get to something you mentioned, which is the Fourth Amendment, and let's remind ourselves. I'm going to quickly read it. The amendment text reads, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized." Turning to Dean Reinstein, what do you see in the Constitution that says that what the president and the NSA are doing is wrong?
Well, I think if it weren't for the existence of FISA, I think the president and the administration would have a much stronger argument. I think that the problem they have is that Congress passed a statute that deals with protecting the civil liberties of Americans in the United States. Never in the history of this country has the Supreme Court ever held or even intimated that a president can use his Article II powers to override a statute of Congress that applies domestically.
Yeah, and,
the president is not above the law.
And Professor Turner, I want to ask you about that. I'm sorry to interrupt, but you were just saying that a statute shouldn't override presidential authority. But as we just heard Dean Reinstein say, many believe it does.
Yeah, Robin, you misunderstood me. I didn't mean to say that the statute doesn't override presidential authority. I say it doesn't override constitutional authority. In the most famous of all Supreme Court cases, Marbury versus Madison, Chief Justice John Marshall said that an act of Congress that was contrary to the Constitution is not law. So what I'm arguing is that when Congress passed FISA, it was violating the Constitution. It was taking away presidential power.
Well, then, as you've heard critics say, work to overturn the statute and do it in a transparent way. But, Dean Reinstein, I just want to cite another a thing that the president's supporters have used in their defense of this wiretapping, which is the authorization from Congress to use military force after September 11th. Just to remind ourselves, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez has cited the case of an American citizen who was captured in Afghanistan, was classified as an enemy combatant. The Supreme Court decision, which was written by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, said President Bush had the power to detain him because Congress gave him that power when they voted on the authorization of use of military force after September 11th. And Attorney General Gonzalez says this, by extension, justifies the domestic surveillance program. Dean Reinstein, your thoughts?
I think it's a real stretch for several reasons. The authorization for the use of military force clearly gave the president the power to invade Afghanistan and to fight the Taliban and al-Qaeda. This resolution didn't give the president the power to arrest and detain somebody for the purpose of acquiring intelligence.
Two questions, one for each of you as we end here. Dean Reinstein, the president has taken this to the court of public opinion, and he's making the case that it's a time of war, and many people, if you listen to talk radio, are agreeing.
I'm not saying that that what the president is doing is unjustified in a military sense. What I'm saying is he's got to act legally, and he's got to get legal authorization to do it. He may very well be right, and I'm not second-guessing him, that the program that the National Security Agency has put together is necessary for part of the fight on the war on terror. That does not give the president the right to violate the laws of the country. And if it's so clear, he can make the case. He can make the case to Congress, and he can get the authority that he needs.
Professor Turner, do you think that there should be no checks and balances on a president?
Well, there ought to be checks and balances in the Constitution, but not in every case. As again, going back to John Marshall in Marbury versus Madison in 1803, Marshall argued, by the Constitution, the president is invested with certain important political powers, in the exercise of which he is to use his own discretion and is accountable only to his country and his political character and to his conscience. If there's lawbreaking going on here, it was when Congress passed a statute trying to seize presidential power in 1978.
We're going to have to leave it at that, gentlemen. Thank you both so much.
My pleasure.
My pleasure, too. And, Bob, it was good talking to you.
You, too.
Two Bobs. Bob Turner, professor at the University of Virginia Law School, co-founder of the Center for National Security. He supports the president's domestic surveillance program. Bob Reinstein, dean of Temple Law School. He believes the president's program breaks the law. This debate is going to continue during congressional hearings that are set for February 6th. And in the courts, several court challenges to the president's policy have been issued, including the case of a convicted terrorist who now says the evidence used against him may have been gathered as part of this domestic surveillance program. He believes the charges against him should be dropped. Well, ahead, what would Washington do? We'll look at how the founding fathers fought over this here and now. Domestic surveillance program. Since 2002, President Bush has authorized the National Security Agency to eavesdrop on international emails and phone calls of Americans suspected of communicating with al-Qaeda operatives. This despite a 1978 law prohibiting such spying without a warrant. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez yesterday defended the practice, saying that presidents throughout history have spied on Americans in time of war, and President Bush's program is legal because of the president's inherent constitutional authority. Well, that debate over presidential powers has been raging since the birth of the country. According to Brown University history professor Gordon Wood, the founding fathers resorted to fisticuffs to try to settle it. And Professor Wood joins us now on the line from his office. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
And in
nice
to have you. And in his speech at Georgetown University yesterday, Attorney General Gonzalez reached back to George Washington when he was commander-in-chief, not yet president, saying that Washington intercepted mail between British and Americans. What sort of spying did go on back then?
Oh, it was extensive. A good deal of spying in the New York area in particular, because the British were occupying the New York City, and Washington had spies everywhere trying to get information from what the British were up to. And, of course, the British had spies, and so you had moles and all kinds of counter-spies. But this was serious business. This was a revolution, and anything went. I mean, there was no constitution. There were no limits, so to speak, on what the commander-in-chief could do.
We understand President Washington, or then commander-in-chief Washington, planted information on the British. And, of course, as you said, Mr. Gonzalez did not point out in his remarks that this was prior to the Constitution. It was as the country was being formed. And then you say this issue of presidential power nearly tore the country apart, because that's what the Founding Fathers were fighting over, you know, a different kind of leadership than the monarchies they'd left. How bad did the fights get?
Oh, very serious. In the 1790s, the issue that divided the country between the Federalists, who Washington's administration, led by Alexander Hamilton, who was Secretary of the Treasury, and the Jeffersonians in opposition, James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, who were opposed to what we might call a robust executive, that brought the country really close to a civil war by 1798. Ended only when the threat of a French invasion seemed to collapse. But it was very scary. But the issue through the whole period really was what were the president's powers? When the Constitution was formed, it was rather vague. The only model they had was the British monarch. Mm-hmm. And how much power did the president have? And Washington experimented. He got burned in his attempt to consult with the Senate. And so he went ahead and acted on his own in foreign policy, issued a proclamation of neutrality in 1793.
And we should say that these fights, before we move on, were because the British monarchs had exclusive rights to make war and peace, and it was their ability to make war that also gave them the power to raise taxes, to pay for the wars, and that's what the Founding Fathers were trying to escape from.
Right, exactly. The great fear, of course, is the British monarch declared war and ran the government, and the Constitution, of course, limits the declaration of war to the Congress. Now, in the last half century or so, we've not followed that. We've been in several wars, four wars, without any declaration of war, which right away gives the president a certain enhanced power. If the Congress is complaining, they blame itself for its negligence over the last half century.
Well, and just again to fill that out a little bit, when the Constitutional Convention met, it took the war declaring authority away from the president and gave it to the Congress. This was a major shift, but as you point out, in recent years, it hasn't been used as much.
Hasn't been used at all.
Yeah.
Since World War II.
And in fact, you argue that President Bush now has much more executive power than presidents at the founding of the country.
Well, that's true, because over the last two centuries, every war, with the exception of the War of 1812, has enhanced the presidential authority considerably. Lincoln, Wilson, and FDR all created much stronger executives as a consequence of the war they were involved in. And so the President Bush has inherited a tradition of war making that is going to be very difficult to contest.
Well, Albert, getting to the spying, the domestic spying, getting back to that, Alberto Gonzalez cited other presidents who also spied on Americans without warrant, without any checks and balance. Woodrow Wilson intercepting cables between Europe and the U.S. in World War I. Franklin Roosevelt intercepting all communication in and out of the U.S. after Pearl Harbor. And then telegraphs, you know, were seized during the Civil War.
Right.
You are a professor of history. With that prism before you, what, in your mind, are some of the hazards and what are some of the pluses of trying to draw parallels between President Bush's surveillance of Americans, again sidestepping a 1978 law, and what past presidents have done?
Well, I think it all depends on, ultimately, in public opinion. It's not going to be easy to solve this problem. To throw it into the courts will be very difficult.
Well, we understand, because a lot of this is of national security. We won't even, in some cases, find out who was spied on.
Well, I think that's right. The courts will probably duck this if they can. They don't want to get involved in a fight between the Congress and the president. Or it's public opinion will eventually decide how much power does the president have. If we should have another terrorist attack, I think the defenders of civil liberties will be on the defensive. So that's the question, and I think events will determine the outcome of this debate. But from the very beginning, the extent of presidential powers has been expanded.
That's really interesting. We only have about a minute left, but you know, others are saying this can't be decided in the court of public opinion, which is obviously where President Bush and his supporters are right now, out on the road making their case, that it has to be decided in Congress and the courts. But you, Gordon Wood, again a professor of history at Brown University, are saying it might be a public opinion that shapes this.
I don't think the judiciary wants to handle such a hot potato. So we'll see what happens. But it would be, I think it'll depend on how all this plays out in terms of events, any further terrorist attacks, and so on.
Yeah. Gordon Wood, professor of history at Brown University. Professor, we'd love to have you back. Fascinating look back as we head forward. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the pros
across the U.S. routinely endure wage violations, injuries, and violent employers. That's a part of the picture painted in a new nationwide study that takes a detailed look at the lives of these jornaleros, as they're known in Spanish. They are mostly Hispanic, often undocumented, and they're at the center of the heated immigration debate here in the U.S. Social scientists at New York's New School University, the University of Illinois at Chicago, and UCLA looked at the demographics of day laborers and produced the study. It's called On the Corner, Day Labor in the U.S., and one of the co-authors joins us now to talk about it. Nick Theodore is the director of the Center for Urban Economic Development at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's also assistant professor of urban planning and policy there as well. Welcome.
Thank you.
And before we talk about what you found, tell us more about how you found it. How did you go about tracking this group? Because it would seem they'd be a hard population to pin down.
We launched a nationwide survey by identifying first a number of states that had day laborers in them, and then sending scouters out to identify the hiring sites that are located in those states. In the end, we interviewed 2,660 day laborers across 20 states and 264 hiring sites. So it really is a nationwide survey of this population.
Well, and before I ask what you found, I guess it's sort of the same. It's the flip side of the same question. Did you go in with any preconceived notions about this group?
One of the big things is we knew that there were extensive violations of labor standards. We knew that we would encounter instances of wage theft, high instances of injuries, and so on. But our findings were so much higher than anything we had anticipated. We found that the day labor market is a labor market where there are rampant violations of labor and employment laws, and where workers are routinely subjected to abusive conditions.
Yeah, you found nearly half were underpaid or were denied food and water and breaks. 20% were subjected to violence by their employers. What kind of violence?
Well, a lot of times it occurs in a general climate of hostility and harassment. And so violence would be violence and threats of violence often were directed at workers. So it might be hitting, punching, pushing, and so on. But that really was a rarer. What was more common were violations of labor standards, like the non-payment of wages you just mentioned, or being abandoned at work sites.
By the way, is there any way to prove what these workers tell you is true?
Well, what we've done is, because there have been a number of other studies in New York, in Los Angeles, in Phoenix, in Atlanta, a lot of our findings are corroborate what those earlier studies had found, as well as the anecdotal reports and investigations that have occurred in some parts of the country. And so the findings of our study are fairly consistent with earlier efforts. So we feel like our results are robust.
Your research shows that the majority of the workers you talk to are illegal immigrants, 75%. But you found a stronger connection between these day laborers and their communities than what many people would expect. What'd you find?
Well, what we found was that many of the hiring sites where day laborers gather are in the neighborhoods where they live. And so they're really searching and working in the neighborhoods where they live, and that these workers are much more connected to the local communities than I think the common stereotype would suggest.
Right, they're not as transient as we might have thought.
Right, there are a number of day laborers, well, many day laborers have worked in this market for a short period of time. There are a number that have been there for many years, and many are long-term residents of the United States. In fact, 25% are U.S. citizens. So it is not, I think common perceptions often allege that this is an entirely undocumented immigrant workforce. Our results do not bear that out. And so we find that many are involved in community activities. More than half attend church. Many are involved in sports clubs and community organizations. And so really, I think these workers are part of the fabric of the communities in which they work and live.
Of course, and when you say documented, undocumented, many people take that strictly to mean whether they're not, whether they're in the country legally.
Yeah.
And as you know, the anti-illegal immigration forces say illegal immigration is a driving force behind the increase in day laborers. That would go on to say taking jobs from Americans. But you say it's the opposite. You say the market is employer-driven.
Yeah.
It's driven by a hunger for home improvement and by employers under pressure to cut wages and benefits.
One of the reasons we reject the idea that hiring sites are magnets for undocumented immigrants is that 83% of the day laborers we have surveyed reported that they learned about the day labor market in the United, while they were in the United States. So this idea that day laborers are learning about the day labor market and then migrating from Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, or elsewhere into this market does not seem to be borne out by the results. I think instead what we're seeing is that often the day labor market is an is the employment of last resort. Over half of the day laborers surveyed had a job in the formal mainstream economy, but then returned to the day labor corner when they lose that job.
Well, you know, it begs a question because of some of the results you found. If this is corrected, this idea that they are facing, for instance, wage violations, will they be as valuable a worker?
Well, you know, we don't want to paint a picture that every employer is out there abusing workers. That simply isn't the case. But we do find very high instances. And so my guess is that we see a lot of repeat employers that are taking advantage of workers. But there are many homeowners and renters that turn to the labor corner as a source of an extra pair of hands to help with a home remodeling project or a gardening project. I think by and large, those employers are not taking advantage of these workers.
Right.
At the same time, we do see rampant problems.
Yeah. Well, so, Professor Nick Theodore, what do you take away from this? How does this information you found fit into the current immigration debate? As you know, President Bush has been talking about clearing a path for illegal workers already in the country, clearing the path for them to become citizens. And that's pleasing the businesses which need workers, but it's enraging some of his core constituents who think that that's, you know, making exceptions in the law, skirting the law for them. So what do you think needs to be done, having, you know, met this population?
Right. Well, I think, unfortunately, the kind of proposals I've been hearing for guest worker programs probably would miss most of the day labor population that happens to be undocumented immigrants. The guest worker programs that are being discussed really are based on a strong attachment to a single employer. So an employer would request a guest worker for a period of time. In the day labor market, a worker may have three or four employers over the course of a single week. So you don't see that kind of strong attachment to an individual employer, even though you see a strong attachment to the labor market. I think what we're hoping is that our study will show that there is a significant workforce out there for which this policy design is inappropriate.
Nick Theodore is the director of the Center for Urban Economic Development at the University of Illinois at Chicago and one of the co-authors of a new nationwide study on day laborers. It's called On the Corner, Day Labor in the United States. Well, as always, we welcome your thoughts on anything on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Please. And still to come, an orchestra that plays traditional Balinese music has a new player, actually a few, robots. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, senators such as John McCain are actually doing the testifying today on Capitol Hill, and Washington is all ears because the topic is lobbying reform. Super lobbyist Jack Abramoff and at least two lawmakers are ensnared in an influence-peddling scandal, and today a Senate committee is considering the many proposals from anxious lawmakers restricting the gifts, trips, and meals that lobbyists can give them. How palpable is the fear? Well, to find out, we called a restaurant, and not just any restaurant. Joining us on the line is Paul Zucconi. He's the co-owner of La Colline, the upscale French restaurant located just two blocks from the Senate side of the Capitol building. And, Paul, you have a saying there about your proximity to power.
Yeah, when we first opened, which is now a little over 24 years ago, of course, we were basically the only kid on the block. And I used to say that no legislation is passed in the halls of Congress until it's discussed over lunch at La Colline.
Yeah. Well, we do understand that you've had slightly less business, partly because of the light congressional calendar. But do you think you're seeing any drop-off because of, you know, lawmakers being nervous about being seen eating with lobbyists?
Not yet.
Do you expect to?
I think initially that if something is in fact, I don't want to say legislated because, you know, let's not forget that, you know, we went through this back in 1996.
Right. They limited individual gifts to about $50, $49.99, with no more than $99.99 in gifts allowed from one source in 1 year. And you saw your sales fall.
Yeah. Well, the business was slow for the first year. She's 20% or so I lost business that first year.
And that's a big chunk. That's like almost $400,000.
Exactly.
For you.
Exactly. And then, you know, gradually it started coming back because I think that more and more fundraising events were taking place as opposed to, you know, one-on-one discussions.
Well, not only that, people stopped paying attention to the restrictions.
I think so. You know, in the beginning, I was calling the possibility of the PERC police being out in force. You know, but again, my rallying cry right now is, you know, regulate as opposed to legislate.
Well, we know that now Democrats want to ban meals from lobbyists' gifts entirely. Republicans want to restrict the meals from the current, as we said, almost $50 to $20. Interestingly, we see that you, Paul Zucconi, implemented a $20 lunch. You did that because, you know, it was slow over the summer, but it seems brilliant now.
I must have been ahead of my time.
It's sort of like a loophole, a menu loophole. But if the meals are restricted, you know, even down to 20, what's that going to do to your income?
I think that initially everyone will be on guard. Whether or not they want to even be seen out at public places with known lobbyists, which I think is nothing wrong with that because of the fact that, you know, the members, the senators, all have a full work day schedule. They cannot be out, you know, on a daily basis spending, you know, an hour and a half to 2 hours over an extended lunch with lobbyists. And this is where the staffers come in. They are the ones that I'm most concerned about. Let the rules apply directly to the members, but not to the staff.
Why are
the ones that are being kept informed of the issues of the day.
By the way, we should note that if these rule restrictions passed, lawmakers can still accept meals if they're part of fundraisers. Do you, as a restaurant owner, anticipate seeing a lot of, you know, fundraisers involving perhaps only two people?
No. No, I do not. Because back in the days of 1996, there was a stipulation, I think, in the rules that, quote, widely attended events. Now, exactly what that means, I don't even know. I didn't know it back then. I don't know what it is today. But I do know that a couple years after that, I doubled the number of banquet rooms that I have in the restaurant.
Well, today the Senate is supposed to begin debate on the nomination of Samuel Alito. There are several Senate hearings taking place, as we said. When lawmakers head over your place, we understand you do something, a little something for them because they have to get in and out so quick?
Well, they're readily available by phone. The offices call over, and right away we get the message to them that there's a vote going on, and they go, and then we keep their meals warm, and they come back and finish if they have the time.
So you keep all these half-eaten plates warm.
You know, it's called a service. Let's not forget, we're a hospitality industry, which provides a service to the guests.
And a discreet one at that. That's Paul Zucconi, co-owner of La Colline, a French restaurant located just two blocks from the Senate side of the Capitol building in Washington, talking to us about what he expects might be the effects of lobbying reform. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Thank you.
scientists announced the creation of a robot that can do sign language. That brings the science of robotics another step away from the assembly line and closer to human contact. But robotic music? Won't it sound like that cheesy theme from The Entertainer on your telephone hold button? No, says Ensemble Robot director Christine Southworth. This week, the ensemble is premiering Heavy Metal, a new piece for Balinese gamelan, robots, and strings. Two new ensemble members, Botticello and Blobot, will participate. Here's a sample from a recent rehearsal. The piece debuts at Music and the Invasion of Technology, part of the When Science Meets Art series underway at the Boston Museum of Science here in Boston. And Christine Southworth joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Hi.
We also welcome Evan Zaporin, the founder and artistic director of the collaborating orchestra, Gamelan Galactica. And welcome to you as well, Evan.
Hi.
And Christine, I want to start with you as a director of Ensemble Robot. You studied, traditional music as well. So how did you migrate from one to the other?
I studied Balinese music first. I was a student at MIT and started playing in the gamelan in around 1999, 2000.
And by the way, for listeners who haven't seen one, what's a gamelan?
A gamelan is a collection of about 30 instruments, metal xylophones, gongs, little tuned gongs, and drums, and little cymbals also. Mm-hmm. It's an orchestra. It's also the people who play the music. Mm-hmm. This one's from Bali,
yeah.
Indonesia.
Right. So you started with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then how did you migrate to robotics?
I had friends at MIT who made robots. And I started writing music when I first went to Bali in 2000. My compositional skills were sort of behind what I wanted to write. So I was writing music that was very complicated for people to play, and I had these friends who made robots, and I thought, wouldn't it be great if I could make some robotic instruments that could just play the music I wrote on my computer, but be acoustic? So they're real instruments that can hear real sounds being made, not just electronic sounds, but they can play from a MIDI sequence.
A MIDI sequence. Jump in, Evan.
It's just a list of events for electronic instruments to play.
So you program something and
right.
then it plays it back.
Right.
But then doesn't that give it that feeling we were talking about of being very stilted? And how do you go from something that just spits it back to you in a programming way to something that gives it warmth and tonality and all that stuff?
We can send it velocities. So that can change the volume on the robot. Everything needs to be translated from the way we write it in a MIDI sequence or in notation to something that's physical being played on fairly simple instruments.
And I want to stop you there because, you know, we think of robots as R2D2. What's his name? R2D2. R2D2, right, him. And they're cute and they're little right. little people. But
they roll around.
Yeah. But this that you're talking about is pretty complex.
I think it's cute. but it doesn't roll around.
Does it have arms? Does it have
This one doesn't, but our new ones do, actually. Our first robot, the Helophon, just plays keys. It has 24 keys. Each key is hit by a solenoid, which is a little plunger
huh.
that hits it. So we send it electric signals, voltages, and it hits the keys.
Well, I want to hear a little more of the sound of the robots playing along with how many musicians?
About 20.
Uh-huh. Let's give a listen to your sound.
Okay.
Beautiful. It sounds like Tinkerbell a little bit.
Doesn't look like Tinkerbell.
No, it sounds like a huge device. Well, Evan Zaporin, as we said, founder of Gamelan Galactica. Let's listen for a minute to the traditional gamelan as you've played it. You've traveled to Bali just this summer. Let's listen to some of the gamelan. a complicated form of music, complex rhythmic patterns. It's only taught orally, isn't that correct?
That's right.
So how does robotics enhance what you do?
For me, what becomes interesting about this project is putting the robots with humans and humans with robots, because that puts both in situations that are a little bit unusual and forces you to think in different ways.
Give me an example.
Well, the robots can play very, very complicated rhythms that would take people months to learn if they were possible at all. But as you mentioned, you know, they have a kind of expression problem. I mean, you have to work really hard to get a robot to be expressive in the way a human musician can.
And how do you do that? How do you get the robot to do that?
You have to kind of fake it one way or the other because, you know, they don't really have feelings as far as we know. But what I was trying to do in my piece is just constantly find ways in which the humans would have to respond to the robot in ways that would make the humans a little bit more mechanical, and then make the robot respond to the humans in ways that would at least give the illusion that the robot mm-hmm. was being expressive.
Is there a way of explaining to non-musicians how you do that?
I could do things with the robot where I could have it play patterns that phased at very small increments, 10 different melodies, each of which were moving at about 1/500th of a second differently than each other. So they start off in unison and they very gradually turn into these beautiful arpeggios without you even noticing this. So you go from these thick chords that suddenly, almost while you're not paying attention, become these beautiful patterns.
Like a waterfall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You could never do that with humans as hard as you tried, right, in that kind of gradual way. So that creates this kind of texture that feels very human. So I made this thing that was very mechanical, you know, right in its very essence, in its conception and its realization, but it creates this very natural musical environment.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because I mentioned you took your 30-member group on a tour of Indonesia, the gamelan, of course, you know, indigenous to Bali. You know, how do you think the traditionalists will feel about suddenly having robots out there with it?
One thing about Bali is that they're very open. They're very secure in their own traditions. I don't think we're trying to replace the tradition in any way. We're just trying to, you know, do some more interesting things with it and push the envelope a little bit. Mm. The other thing is that it's that very handmade nature of gamelan that makes it increasingly foreign to Americans. You know, we're used to getting our music over the internet or on electric guitars or, you know, right. on things that are very manufactured one way or another. And there's something about bringing those two things together that I think is very important, you know.
And produces an amazing sound. That's Evan Saporin, composer, MIT professor, and director of Gamelan Galactica. We also spoke with fellow composer and ensemble robot conductor Christine Southworth. For pictures, music, and more on their collaboration with robots, go to our website, here-now.org. And thanks so much to both of you for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these